doleful steps in the direction of Mr. Runciter's final home?" Joe groaned and stared out through the window of the chopper, fixing his attention on the buildings that made up the installations of Zurich Field.
"Yeah, take off,"
Al said. As the chopper left the ground, the moratorium owner pressed a button on his control panel. Throughout the cabin of the chopper, from a dozen sources, the sound of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis rolled forth sonorously, the many voices saying, "Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccata mundi," over and over again, accompanied by an electronically augmented symphony orchestra.
"Did you know that Toscanini used to sing along with the singers when he conducted an opera?"
Joe said.
"That in his recording of Traviata, you can hear him during the aria Sempre Libera?"
"I didn't know that,"
Al said. He watched the sleek, sturdy connaps of Zurich move by below, a dignified and stately procession, which Joe also found himself watching.
"Libera me, domine,"
Joe said.
"What's that mean?"
Joe said.
"It means, God have mercy on me."
"Don't you know that? Doesn't everybody know that?"
"What made you think of it?"
Al said.
"The music. The goddamn music."
To Von Vogelsung, he said, "Turn the music off. Runciter can't hear it. I'm the only one who can hear it, and I don't feel like hearing it."
To Al, he said,
"You don't want to hear it, do you?"
Al said,
"Calm down, Joe.
We're carrying our dead employer to a place called the Beloved Brethren Moratorium," Joe said. "And he says calm down. You know, Runciter didn't have to go with us to Luna. He could have dispatched us and stayed in New York. So now the most life-loving, full-living man I ever met has been..."
"Your dark-skinned companion's advice is good,"
the moratorium owner chimed in.
"What advice?" Joe said.
"To calm yourself."
Von Vogelsung opened the glove compartment of the chopper's control panel. He handed Joe a merry, multicolored box.
"Chew one of these, Mr. Chip."
"Tranquilizing gum,"
Joe said, accepting the box. Reflexively, he opened it.
"Peach-flavored tranquilizing gum."
To Al, he said,
"Do I have to take this?"
"You should,"
Al said.
Joe said, "Runciter would never have taken a tranquilizer under circumstances of this sort. Glenn Runciter never took a tranquilizer in his life."
"You know what I realize now, Al? He gave his life to save ours, in an indirect way."
"Very indirect,"
Al said.
"Here we are,"
he said. The chopper had begun to descend toward a target painted on a flat roof field below.
"You think you can compose yourself?"
he asked Joe.
"I can compose myself," Joe said, "when I hear Runciter's voice again, when I know some form of life, half-life, is still there."
The moratorium owner said cheerily,
"I wouldn't worry on that score, Mr. Chip. We generally obtain an adequate proto-phasonic flow. At first, it is later, when the half-life period has expended itself, that the heartache arises. But with sensible planning, that can be forestalled for many years."
He shut off the motor of the chopper, touched a stud which caused the cabin door to slide back.
"Welcome to the Beloved Brethren Moratorium," he said.
He ushered the two of them out onto the roof field.
"My personal secretary, Miss Beeson, will escort you to a consultation lounge. If you will wait there, being subliminally influenced into peace of soul by the colors and texture surrounding you, I will have Mr. Runciter brought in as soon as my technicians establish contact with him."
"I want to be present at the whole process," Joe said. "I want to see your technicians bring him back."
To Al, the moratorium owner said,
"Maybe, as his friend, you can make him understand."
"We have to wait in the lounge, Joe,"
Al said. Joe looked at him fiercely.
"Uncle Tom," he said.
"All the moratoriums work this way,"
Al said.
"Come on with me to the lounge."
"How long will it take?"
Joe asked the moratorium owner.
"We'll know one way or another within the first 15 minutes. if we haven't gotten a measurable signal by then.
You're only going to try for 15 minutes? Joe said. To Al, he said,
They're only going to try for 15 minutes to bring back a man greater than all of us put together.
He felt like crying, aloud.
Come on,
he said to Al.
Let's...
You come on, Al repeated. To the lounge. Joe followed him into the lounge.
Cigarette?
Al said, seating himself on a synthetic buffalo hide couch. He held his pack up to Joe.
Have a stale, Joe said.
He didn't need to take one, to touch one, to know that.
Yeah, so they are.
Al put the pack away.
How did you know?
He waited.
You get discouraged easier than anyone I ever ran into. We're lucky to be alive. It could be us, all of us, in that cold pack there. And Runciter's sitting out here in this lounge with these nutty colors.
He looked at his watch. Joe said, All the cigarettes in the world are stale. He examined his own watch. 10 after. He pondered, having many disjointed and unconnected brooding thoughts. They swam through him like silvery fish, fears and mild dislikes and apprehensions, and all the silvery fish recirculating to begin once more as fear.
If Runciter were alive, he said, sitting out here in this lounge, everything would be okay. I know it, but I don't know why.
He wondered what was, at this moment, going on between the moratorium's technicians and the remains of Glenn Runciter.
Do you remember dentists?
He asked Al.
I don't remember, but I know what they were.
People's teeth used to decay.
I realized that, Al said.
My father told me what it used to feel like, waiting in a dentist's office. Every time the nurse opened the door, you thought, it's happening. The thing I've been afraid of all my life.
And that's what you feel now?
Al asked.
I feel... Christ, why doesn't that half-wit sap who runs this place come in here and say he's alive? Runciter's alive. Or else he's not. One way or another. Yes or no?
It's almost always yes. Statistically, as Vogelsong said.
In this case, it'll be no.
You have no way of knowing that, Joe said.
I wonder if Ray Hollis has an outlet here in Zurich.
Of course he has. But by the time you get a precog in here, we'll already know anyhow.
I'll phone up a precog, Joe said. I'll get one on the line right now.
He started to his feet, wondering where he could find a vidphone.
Give me a quarter.
Al shook his head.
In a manner of speaking, Joe said, you're my employee. You have to do what I say or I'll fire you. As soon as Runciter died, I took over management of the firm. I've been in charge since the bomb went off. It was my decision to bring him here, and it's my decision to rent the use of a precog for a couple of minutes. Let's have the quarter.
He held out his hand.
Runciter Associates, Al said, being run by a man who can't keep 50 cents on him. Here's a quarter.
He got it from his pocket, tossed it to Joe.
When you make out my paycheck, add it on.
Joe left the lounge and wandered down a corridor, rubbing his forehead blearily.
This is an unnatural place, he thought. Halfway between the world and death. I am head of Runciter Associates now, he realized. Except for Ella, who isn't alive and can only speak if I visit this place and have her revived. I know the specifications in Glenn Runciter's will, which now have automatically gone into effect. I'm supposed to take over until Ella, or Ella and he, if he can be revived, decide on someone to replace him. They have to agree. Both wills make that mandatory. Maybe, he thought, they'll decide I can do it on a permanent basis.
Ah, that'll never come about,
he realized. Not for someone who can't manage his own personal fiscal responsibilities.
That's something else Hollis's precog would know,
he realized.
I can find out from them whether or not I'll be upgraded to director of the firm. That would be worth knowing, along with everything else. And I have to hire the precog anyhow. Which way to a public vidphone?
He asked a uniformed employee of the moratorium. The employee pointed.
Thanks,
he said, and wandered on, coming at last to the pay vidphone. He lifted the receiver, listened for the dial tone, and then dropped in the quarter which Al had given him. The phone said,
"I am sorry, sir, but I can't accept obsolete money."
The quarter clattered out of the bottom of the phone and landed at his feet, expelled in disgust.
"What do you mean?"
he said, stooping awkwardly to retrieve the coin.
"Since when is a North American Confederation quarter obsolete?"
"I am sorry, sir," the phone said. "The coin which you put into me was not a North American Confederation quarter, but a recalled issue of the United States of America's Philadelphia Mint. It is of merely numismatical interest now."
Joe examined the quarter and saw on its tarnished surface the bas-relief profile of George Washington and the date. The coin was 40 years old and, as the phone had said, long ago recalled.
"Having difficulties, sir?"
a moratorium employee asked, walking over pleasantly.
"I saw the phone expel your coin. May I examine it?"
He held out his hand, and Joe gave him the U.S. quarter.
"I will trade you a current Swiss 10-franc token for this, which the phone will accept."
"Fine," Joe said. He made the trade, dropped the 10-franc piece into the phone, and dialed Hollis's international toll-free number.
"Hollis Talents,"
a polished female voice said in his ear, and on the screen, a girl's face, modified by artificial beauty aids of an advanced nature, manifested itself.
"Oh, Mr. Chip,"
the girl said, recognizing him.
"Mr. Hollis left word with us that you'd call. We've been expecting you all afternoon."
"Precogs," Joe thought.
"Mr. Hollis," the girl said, "instructed us to put your call through to him. He wants to handle your needs personally. Would you hold on a moment while I put you through? So, just a moment, Mr. Chip. The next voice that you hear will be Mr. Hollis's, God willing."
Her face vanished. He confronted a blank gray screen. A grim blue face with recessive eyes swam into focus, a mysterious countenance floating without neck or body. The eyes reminded him of flawed jewels. They shone, but the faceting had gone wrong. The eyes scattered light in irregular directions.
"Hello, Mr. Chip."
"So this is what he looks like," Joe thought. Photographs haven't caught this, the imperfect planes and surfaces, as if the whole brittle edifice had once been dropped, had broken, had then been re-glued, but not quite as before. "The society," Joe said, "we'll receive a full report on your murder of Glenn Runciter. They own a lot of legal talent. You'll be in court the rest of your life." He waited for the face to react, but it did not.
"We know you did it,"
he said, and felt the futility of it, the pointlessness of what he was doing.
"As to the purpose of your call,"
Hollis said in a slithering voice which reminded Joe of snakes crawling over one another.
"Mr. Runciter will not."
Shaking, Joe hung up the receiver. He walked back up the corridor along which he had come. He reached the lounge once more where Al Hammond sat morosely picking apart a dry-as-dust former cigarette. There was a moment of silence, and then Al raised his head.
"It's no," Joe said. "Vogel's son came around looking for you," Al said. "He acted very strange, and it was obvious what's been going on back there. Six'll get you eight, he's afraid to tell you outright. He'll probably go through a long routine, but it'll boil down like you say. It'll boil down to no. So, what now?"
He waited.
"Now, we get Hollis," Joe said. "We won't get Hollis. The society..."
He broke off. The owner of the moratorium had sidled into the lounge, looking nervous and haggard, but attempting at the same time to emit an aura of detached, austere prowess.
"We did what we could. At such low temperatures, the flow of current is virtually unimpeded. There's no perceptible resistance at minus 150 G. The signal should have bounced out clear and strong, but all we got from the amplifier was a 60-cycle hum. Remember, however, that we did not supervise the original cold pack installation. Bear that in mind.
Al said, "We have it in mind."
He rose stiffly to his feet and stood facing Joe.
"I guess that's it."
"I'll talk to Ella," Joe said.
"Now?"
Al said.
"You better wait until you know what you're gonna say. Tell her tomorrow. Go home and get some sleep."
"To go home," Joe said, "is to go home to Pat Conley. I'm in no shape to cope with her either."
"Take a hotel room here in Zurich," Al said. "Disappear. I'll go back to the ship, tell the others, and report to the society. You can delegate it to me in writing."
To von Vogelsong, he said,
"Bring us a pen and a sheet of paper."
"You know who I feel like talking to?"
Joe said, as the moratorium owner scuttled off in search of pen and paper.
"Wendy Wright. She'll know what to do. I value her opinion. Why is that, I wonder? I barely know her."
He noticed then that subtle background music hung over the lounge. It had been there all this time, the same as on the chopper. Dies Irae, Dies Illa, the voices sang darkly. Solvit Seclum in Favilla, Teste David cum Sibylla. The Verdi Requiem, he realized. Von Vogelsong, probably personally with his own two hands, switched it on at 9 a.m. every morning when he arrived for work.
"Once you get your hotel room," Al said, "I could probably talk Wendy Wright into showing up there."
"Oh, that would be immoral," Joe said.
"What?"
Al stared at him.
"At a time like this, when the whole organization is about to sink into oblivion unless you can pull yourself together? Anything that'll make you function is desirable. In fact, necessary. Go back to the phone, call a hotel, come back here, and tell me the name of the hotel and the..."
"All our money's worthless," Joe said. "I can't operate the phone, not unless I can find a coin collector who'll trade me another Swiss 10-franc piece of current issue."
"Jeez," Al said.
He let out his breath in a groaning sigh and shook his head.
"Is it my fault?" Joe said. "Did I make that quarter you gave me obsolete?"
He felt anger.
"In some weird way," Al said. "Yes, it is your fault. But I don't know how. Maybe one day I'll figure it out." "Okay, we'll both go back to Pratfall too. You can pick Wendy right up there and take her to the hotel with you."
"Quantus tremor est futurus," the voices sang. "Quando judex est venturus, cuncta stricte discussurus."
"What'll I pay the hotel with? They won't take our money any more than the phone will."
Cursing, Al yanked out his wallet, examined the bills in it.
"These are old, but still in circulation."
He inspected the coins in his pockets.
"These aren't in circulation."
He tossed the coins to the carpet of the lounge, ridding himself, as the phone had, in disgust.
"Take these bills."
He handed the paper currency to Joe.
"There's enough there for the hotel room for one night, dinner, and a couple of drinks for each of you. I'll send a ship from New York tomorrow to pick you and her up."
"I'll pay you back," Joe said. "As pro tem director of Runciter Associates, I'll draw a higher salary. I'll be able to pay all my debts off, including the back taxes, penalties, and fines which the income tax people..."
"Without Pat Conley? Without her help?"
"I can throw her out now," Joe said.
Al said,
"I wonder."
"This is a new start for me, a new lease on life. I can run the firm," he said to himself. "Certainly I won't make the mistake that Runciter made. Hollis, posing as Stanton Mick, won't lure me and my inertials off Earth where we can be gotten at."
"In my opinion,"
Al said hollowly,
"you have a will to fail. No combination of circumstances, including this, is gonna change that."
What I actually have, Joe said, is a will to succeed. Glenn Runciter saw that, which is why he specified in his will that I take over in the event of his death and the failure of the Beloved Brethren Moratorium to revive him into half-life, or any other reputable moratorium as specified by me.
Within him, his confidence rose. He saw now the manifold possibilities ahead, as clearly as if he had precog abilities. And then he remembered Pat's talent, what she could do to precogs, to any attempt to foresee the future. Tuba mirum spargin sanum, the voices sang. Per sepulcra regianum, caget omnes ante tranum. Reading his expression, Al said,
You're not gonna throw her out. Not with what she can do.
I'll rent a room at the Zurich Roots Hotel, Joe decided, as per your outlying proposal. But, he thought, Al's right. It won't work. Pat, or even something worse, will move in and destroy me. I'm doomed, in the classic sense.
An image thrust itself into his agitated, fatigued mind. A bird caught in cobwebs. Age hung about the image, and this frightened him. This aspect of it seemed literal and real. And, he thought, prophetic. But he could not make out exactly how.
The coins, he thought.
Out of circulation, rejected by the phone, collector's items, like ones found in museums. Is that it? Hard to say. He really didn't know. Mars stupebit, the voices sang. Et natura cum resurgit creatura. Judicanti responsura. They sang on and on. 8.
If money worries have you in the cellar, go visit the lady at Ubik Savings and Loan. She'll take the frets out of your debts. Suppose, for example, you borrow 59 pos creds on an interest-only loan. Let's see. That adds up to...
Daylight rattled through the elegant hotel room, uncovering stately shapes, which Joe Chip blinkingly saw were articles of furnishings, great hand-painted drapes of a neo-silkscreen sort that depicted man's ascent from the unicellular organisms of the Cambrian period to the first heavier-than-air flight at the beginning of the 20th century. A magnificent pseudo-mahogany dresser, 4 variegated crypto-chrome-plated reclining chairs. He groggily admired the splendor of the hotel room, and then he realized with a tremor of keen disappointment that Wendy had not come knocking at the door. Or else he had not heard her. He had been sleeping too deeply. Thus, the new empire of his hegemony had vanished in the moment it had begun. With numbing gloom, a remnant of yesterday, pervading him, he lurched from the big bed, found his clothes, and dressed. It was cold, unusually so. He noticed that and pondered on it. Then he lifted the phone receiver and dialed for room service.
Pay him back, if at all possible,
the receiver declared in his ear.
First, of course, it has to be established whether Stanton Mick actually involved himself, or if a mere homo simulacric substitute was in action against us, and if so, why? And if not, then how?
The voice droned on, speaking to itself and not to Joe. It seemed as unaware of him as if he did not exist.
From all our previous reports, the voice declared, it would appear that Mick acts generally in a reputable manner and in accord with legal and ethical practices established throughout the system. In view of this,
Joe hung up the phone and stood dizzily swaying, trying to clear his head.
Runciter's voice,
beyond any doubt. He again picked up the phone, listened once more.
Lawsuit by Mick, who can afford and is accustomed to litigation of that nature. Our own legal staff certainly should be consulted before we make a formal report to the society. It would be libel if made public and grounds for a suit claiming false arrest if...
Runciter,
Joe said. He said it loudly.
Unable to verify, probably for at least...
Joe hung up.
I don't understand this, he said to himself.
Going into the bathroom, he splashed icy water on his face, combed his hair with a sanitary, free hotel comb, then, after meditating for a time, shaved with the sanitary, free hotel throwaway razor. He slapped sanitary, free hotel aftershave onto his chin, neck, and jowls, unwrapped the sanitary, free hotel glass, and drank from it.
Did the moratorium finally manage to revive him?
He wondered.
And wired him up to my phone? Runciter, as soon as he came around, would want to talk to me, probably before anyone else. But if so, why can't he hear me back? Why does it consist of one-way transmission only? Is it only a technical defect which will clear up?
Returning to the phone, he picked up the receiver once more, with the idea of calling the beloved Brethren Moratorium.
Not the ideal person to manage the firm in view of his confused personal difficulties, particularly...
I can't call,
Joe realized. He hung up the receiver.
I can't even get room service.
In a corner of the large room, a chime sounded, and a tinkling mechanical voice called,
I'm your free homeopathe machine. A service supplied exclusively by all the fine Roots hotels throughout Earth and the colonies. Simply dial the classification of news that you wish, and in a matter of seconds, I'll speedily provide you with the fresh, up-to-the-minute homeopape tailored to your individual requirements. And, let me repeat, at no cost to you.
Okay,
Joe said, and crossed the room to the machine. Maybe by now, he reflected, news of Runciter's murder has gotten out. The news media cover all admissions to moratoriums routinely. He pressed the button marked High Type Interplan Info. At once, the machine began to clank out a printed sheet, which he gathered up as fast as it emerged. No mention of Runciter. Too soon? Or had the society managed to suppress it? Or Al, he thought. Maybe Al slipped a few pause creds to the owner of the moratorium. But he himself had all of Al's money. Al couldn't buy off anybody to do anything.
A knock sounded on the hotel room door. Putting down the homeopape, Joe made his way cautiously to the door, thinking,
it's probably Pat Conley. She's trapped me here. On the other hand, it might be someone from New York, here to pick me up and take me back there. Theoretically, he conjectured, it could even be Wendy.
But that did not seem likely. Not now, not this late.
It could also be an assassin dispatched by Hollis. He could be killing us off one by one.
Joe opened the door. Quivering with unease, wringing his pulpy hands together, Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsang stood in the doorway, mumbling.
I just don't understand it, Mr. Chip. We worked all night in relays. We just are not getting a single spark. And yet we ran an electroencephalograph, and the gram shows faint but unmistakable cerebral activity. So the afterlife is there, but we still can't seem to tap it. We've got probes at every part of the cortex now. I don't know what else we can do, sir.
Is there measurable brain metabolism?
Joe asked.
Yes, sir. We called in an outside expert from another moratorium, and he detected it using his own equipment. It's a normal amount, too, just what you'd expect immediately after death.
How did you know where to find me? Joe asked.
We called Mr. Hammond in New York. Then I tried to call you here at your hotel, but your phone has been busy all morning. That's why I found it necessary to come here in person.
It's broken, Joe said. The phone. I can't call out, either.
The moratorium owner said,
Mr. Hammond tried to contact you, too, with no success. He asked me to give you a message from him, something he wants you to do here in Zurich before you start back to New York.
He wants to remind me, Joe said, to consult Ella.
To tell her about her husband's unfortunate, untimely death.
Can I borrow a couple of pause creds from you? Joe said. So I can eat breakfast?
Mr. Hammond warned me that you would try to borrow money from me. He informed me that he already provided you with sufficient funds to pay for your hotel room, plus a round of drinks, as well as...
Al based his estimate on the assumption that I would rent a more modest room than this. However, nothing smaller than this was available, which Al did not foresee. You can add it on to the statement which you will be presenting to Runciter Associates at the end of the month. I am, as Al probably told you, now acting director of the firm. You're dealing with a positive-thinking, powerful man here, who's worked his way step by step to the top. I could, as you must well realize, reconsider our basic policy decision as to which moratorium we wish to patronize. We might, for example, prefer one near New York.
Grumpily, von Vogelsung reached within his tweed toga and brought out an ersatz alligator skin wallet, which he dug into.
It's a harsh world we're living in, Joe said, accepting the money. The rule is dog eat dog.
Mr. Hammond gave me further information to pass on to you. The ship from your New York office will arrive in Zurich 2 hours from now, approximately.
Fine, Joe said.
In order for you to have ample time to confer with Ella Runciter, Mr. Hammond will have the ship pick you up at the moratorium. In view of this, Mr. Hammond suggests that I take you back to the moratorium with me. My chopper is parked on the hotel roof.
Al Hammond said that? That I should return to the moratorium with you?
That's right.
Von Vogelsung nodded.
A tall, stoop-shouldered Negro, about 30 years old, with gold-cap front teeth, each with an ornamental design. The one on the left a heart, the next a club, the one on the right a diamond.
The man who came with us from Zurich Field yesterday, who waited with you at the moratorium.
Joe said. Did he have on green felt knickers, gray golf socks, badger hide open midriff blouse, and imitation patent leather pumps?
I couldn't see what he wore. I just saw his face on the vidscreen.
Did he convey any specific code words so I could be sure it was him?
The moratorium owner, peeved, said,
I don't understand the problem, Mr. Chip. The man who talked to me on the vidphone from New York is the same man you had with you yesterday.
I can't take a chance, Joe said, on going with you, on getting into your chopper. Maybe Ray Hollis sent you. It was Ray Hollis who killed Mr. Runciter.
His eyes like glass buttons, von Vogelsung said.
Did you inform the Prudence Society of this?
We will. We'll get around to it in due time. Meanwhile, we have to watch out that Hollis doesn't get the rest of us. He intended to kill us, too, there on Luna.
You need protection,
the moratorium owner said.
I suggest you go immediately to your phone and call the Zurich police. They'll assign a man to cover you until you leave for New York. And as soon as you arrive in New York...
My phone, as I said, is broken. All I get on it is the voice of Glenn Runciter. That's why no one could reach me.
Really? How very unusual.
The moratorium owner undulated past him into the hotel room.
May I listen?
He picked up the phone receiver questioningly.
One poscred, Joe said.
Digging into the pockets of his tweed toga, the moratorium owner fished out a handful of coins. His airplane propeller beanie whirred irritably as he handed 3 of the coins to Joe.
I'm only charging you what they ask around here for a cup of coffee, Joe said. This ought to be worth at least that much.
Thinking that, he realized that he had had no breakfast, and that he would be facing Ella in that condition. Well, he could take an amphetamine instead. The hotel probably provided them free, as a courtesy. Holding the phone receiver tightly against his ear, von Vogelsung said,
I don't hear anything, not even a dial tone. Now I hear a little static, as if from a great distance, very faint.
He held the receiver out to Joe, who took it and also listened. He, too, heard only the far-off static. From thousands of miles away, he thought. Eerie, as perplexing in its own way as the voice of Runciter, if that was what it had been.
I'll return your poscred, he said, hanging up the receiver.
Never mind,
von Vogelsung said.
But you didn't get to hear his voice.
Let's return to the moratorium. As your Mr. Hammond requested.
Joe said,
Al Hammond is my employee. I make policy. I think I'll return to New York before I talk to Ella. In my opinion, it's more important to frame our formal notification to the Society. When you talked to Al Hammond, did he say whether all the inertials left Zurich with him?
All but the girl who spent the night with you, here in the hotel.
Puzzled, the moratorium owner looked around the room, obviously wondering where she was. His peculiar face fused over with concern.
Isn't she here?
Which girl was it? Joe asked. His morale, already low, plunged into the blackest depths of his mind.
Mr. Hammond didn't say. He assumed you'd know. It would have been indiscreet for him to tell me her name, considering the circumstances. Didn't she?
Nobody showed up. Which had it been, Pat Conley or Wendy? He prowled about the hotel room, reflexively working off his fear.
I hope to God, he thought, that it was Pat.
In the closet,
von Vogelsong said.
What?
He stopped pacing.
Maybe you ought to look in there. These more expensive suites have extra large closets.
Joe touched the stud of the closet door. Its spring-loaded mechanism sent it flying open. On the floor of the closet, a huddled heap, dehydrated, almost mummified, lay curled up. Decaying shreds of what seemingly had once been cloth covered most of it, as if it had, by degrees, over a long period of time, retracted into what remained of its garments. Bending, he turned it over. It weighed only a few pounds. At the push of his hand, its limbs folded out into thin, bony extensions that rustled like paper. Its hair seemed enormously long, wiry and tangled. The black cloud of hair obscured its face. He crouched, not moving, not wanting to see who it was. In a strangled voice, von Vogelsong rasped,
"That's old. Completely dried out. Like it's been here for centuries. I'll go down and tell the manager."
"It can't be an adult woman," Joe said. "These could only be the remnants of a child. They were just too small." "It can't be either Pat or Wendy," he said, and lifted the cloudy hair away from its face. "It's like it was in a kiln," he said, "at a very high temperature, for a long time." The blast, he thought, the severe heat from the bomb. He stared silently then at the shriveled, heat-darkened little face, and knew who this was. With difficulty, he recognized her. Wendy Wright.
Sometime during the night, he reasoned, she had come into the room, and then some process had started in her or around her. She had sensed it and had crept off, hiding herself in the closet, so he wouldn't know. In her last few hours of life, or perhaps minutes, he hoped it was only minutes, this had overtaken her, but she had made no sound. She hadn't wakened him.
Or, he thought, she tried and she couldn't do it, couldn't attract my attention. Maybe it was after that, after trying and failing to wake me, that she crawled into this closet. I pray to God, he thought, that it happened fast.
You can't do anything for her?
He asked von Vogelsong.
At your moratorium?
Not this late. There wouldn't be any residual half-life left, not with this complete deterioration. Is she the girl?
Yes, he said, nodding.
You better leave this hotel, right now, for your own safety. Hollis, it is Hollis, isn't it? We'll do this to you, too.
My cigarettes, Joe said, dried out. The two-year-old phone book in the ship, the sour cream and coffee with scum on it, mold on it, the antiquated money.
A common thread, age.
She said that back on Luna, after we made it up to the ship. She said, I feel old.
He pondered, trying to control his fear. It had begun now to turn into terror.
But the voice on the phone, he thought. Runciter's voice. What did that mean?
He saw no underlying pattern, no meaning. Runciter's voice on the vidphone fitted no theory which he could summon up or imagine.
Radiation, von Vogelsong said. It would seem to me that she was exposed to extensive radioactivity, probably some time ago. An enormous amount of it, in fact,
Joe said.
I think she died because of the blast, the explosion that killed Runciter. Cobalt particles, he said to himself. Hot dust that settled on her and which she inhaled. But then, we're all gonna die this way. It must have settled on all of us. I have it in my own lungs. So does Al. So do the other inertials. There's nothing that can be done in that case. It's too late. We didn't think of that, he realized. It didn't occur to us that the explosion consisted of a micronic nuclear reaction. No wonder Hollis allowed us to leave. And yet... That explained Wendy's death, and it explained the dried-out cigarettes, but not the phone book, not the coins, not the corruption of the cream and coffee. Nor did it explain Runciter's voice, the yammering monologue on the hotel room's vidphone, which ceased when von Vogelsang lifted the receiver. When someone else tried to hear it, he realized. I've got to get back to New York, he said to himself. All of us who were there on Luna, all of us who were present when the bomb blast went off, we have to work this out together. In fact, it's probably the only way it can be worked out. Before the rest of us die, one by one, the way Wendy did. Or in a worse way, if that's possible. Have the hotel management send a polyethylene bag up here, he said to the moratorium owner. I'll put her in it and take her with me to New York.
Isn't this a matter for the police? A horrible murder like this, they should be informed.
Joe said, just get me the bag.
All right. It's your employee.
The moratorium owner started off down the hall.
Was once, Joe said. Not anymore. It would have to be her first, he said to himself. But maybe, in a sense, that's better. Wendy, he thought. I'm taking you with me, taking you home.
But not as he had planned. To the other inertials seated around the massive, genuine oak conference table, Al Hammond said, breaking abruptly into the joint silence,
Joe should be back any time now.
He looked at his wristwatch to make certain. It appeared to have stopped.
Meanwhile,
Pat Conley said,
I suggest we watch the late afternoon news on TV to see if Hollis has leaked out the news of Runciter's death. It wasn't in the paper today,
Edie Dorn said.
The TV news is much more recent,
Pat said. She handed Al a 50-cent piece with which to start up the TV set mounted behind curtains at the far end of the conference room, an impressive 3D color polyphonic mechanism which had been a source of pride to Runciter.
Want me to put it in the slot for you, Mr. Hammond?
Sammy Mundo asked eagerly.
Okay,
Al said. Broodingly, he tossed the coin to Mundo, who caught it and trotted toward the set. Restlessly, Walter W. Wales, Runciter's attorney, shifted about in his chair, fiddled with his fine-veined, aristocratic hands at the clasp lock of his briefcase, and said,
You people should not have left Mr. Chip in Zurich. We can do nothing until he arrives here, and it's extremely vital that all matters pertaining to Mr. Runciter's will be expedited.
You've read the will, Al said, and so has Joe Chip. We know Runciter wanted to take over management of the firm.
But from a legal standpoint,
Wales began.
It won't take much longer,
Al said brusquely. With his pen, he scratched random lines along the borders of the list he had made. Preoccupied, he embroidered the list, then read it once again.
Stale cigarettes. Out-of-date phone book. Obsolete money. Putrefied food. Ad on match folder. I'm gonna pass this list around the table once more, he said aloud, and see if this time anyone can spot a connective link between these five occurrences, or whatever you want to call them, these five things that are,
he gestured.
Are wrong,
John Ild said. Pat Conley said,
It's easy to see the connective between the first four, but not the match folder. That doesn't fit in.
Let me see the match folder again, Al said, reaching out his hand.
Pat gave him the match folder, and once again he read the ad. Amazing opportunity for advancement to all who can qualify. Mr. Glenn Runciter of the Beloved Brethren Moratorium of Zurich, Switzerland, doubled his income within a week of receiving our free shoe kit with detailed information as to how you also can sell our authentic simulated leather loafers to friends, relatives, business associates. Mr. Runciter, although helplessly frozen in cold pack, earned 400... Al stopped reading. He pondered, meanwhile picking at a lower tooth with his thumbnail.
Yes, he thought. This is different, this ad. The others consist of obsolescence and decay, but not this.
I wonder, he said aloud, what would happen if we answered this match folder ad? It gives a box number in Des Moines, Iowa.
We get a free shoe kit,
Pat Conley said,
with detailed information as to how we too can...
Maybe.
Al interrupted.
We find ourselves in contact with Glenn Runciter.
Everyone at the table, including Walter W. Wales, stared at him.
I mean it, he said. Here.
He handed the match folder to Tippy Jackson.
Write them stamp mail.
And say what?
Tippy Jackson asked.
Just fill out the coupon,
Al said. To Edie Dorn, he said,
are you absolutely sure you've had that match folder in your purse since late last week? Or could you have picked it up somewhere today?
Edie Dorn said,
I put several match folders in my purse on Wednesday. As I told you this morning on my way here, I happened to notice this one as I was lighting a cigarette. It definitely has been in my purse from before we went to Luna, from several days before.
With that ad on it?
John Ild asked her.
I never noticed what the match folder said before. I only noticed this today. I can't say anything about it before. Who can?
Nobody can, Don Denny said. What do you think, Al? A gag by Runciter? Did he have him printed up before his death? Or Hollis, maybe? As a sort of grotesque joke, knowing that he was going to kill Runciter. That by the time we noticed the match folder, Runciter would be in cold pack in Zurich, like the match folder says.
Tito Aposto said,
how would Hollis know we'd take Runciter to Zurich, and not to New York?
Because Ella's there,
Don Denny answered. At the TV set, Sammy Mundo stood silently inspecting the 50-cent piece which Al had given him. His underdeveloped, pale forehead had wrinkled up into a perplexed frown.
What's the matter, Sam?
Al said. He felt himself tense up inwardly. He foresaw another happening.
Isn't Walt Disney's head supposed to be on the 50-cent piece?
Sammy said.
Either Disney's, Al said, or if it's an older one, then Fidel Castro's. Let's see it.
Another obsolete coin,
Pat Conley said, as Sammy carried the 50-cent piece to Al.
No,
Al said, examining the coin.
It's last year's. Perfectly good date-wise. Perfectly acceptable. Any machine in the world would take it. The TV set would take it.
Then, what's the matter?
Edie Dorn asked timidly.
Exactly what Sam said, Al answered. It has the wrong head on it.
He got up, carried the coin over to Edie, deposited it in her moist, open hand.
Who does it look like to you?
After a pause, Edie said,
I don't know.
Sure you know,
Al said.
Okay,
Edie said sharply, goaded into replying against her will. She pushed the coin back at him, ridding herself of it with a shiver of aversion.
It's Runciter,
Al said to all of them seated around the big table. After a pause, Tippy Jackson said,
add that to your list.
Her voice was barely audible.
I see two processes at work,
Pat said presently, as Al reseated himself and began to make the addendum on his piece of paper.
One, a process of deterioration. That seems obvious. We agree on that.
Raising his head, Al said to her,
What's the other?
I'm not quite sure.
Pat hesitated.
Something to do with Runster. I think we should look at all our other coins, and paper money, too. Let me think a little longer.
One by one, the people at the table got out their wallets, purses, rummaged in their pockets.
I have a 5 poscred note,
John Ild said,
with a beautiful steel engraving portrait of Mr. Runciter. The rest?
He took a long look at what he held.
They're normal. They're okay. Do you want to see the 5 poscred note, Mr. Hammond?
Al said, I've got 2 of them already. Who else?
He looked around the table. 6 hands had gone up.
8 of us,
he said.
Have what I guess we should call Runciter money now, to some extent. Probably by the end of the day, all the money will be Runciter money. I'll give it 2 days. Anyhow, Runciter money will work. It'll start machines and appliances, and we can pay our debts with it.
Maybe not,
Don Denny said.
Why do you think so? Except that what you call Runciter money.
He tapped a bill he held.
Is there any reason why the bank should honor it? It's not a legitimate issue. The government didn't put it out. It's funny money. It's not real.
Okay, Al said reasonably. Maybe it's not real. Maybe the banks will refuse it, but that's not the real question.
The real question,
Pat Conley said,
is what does this second process consist of? These manifestations of Runciter.
That's what they are,
Don Denny nodded.
Manifestations of Runciter, that's the second process, along with the decay. Some coins get obsolete. Others show up with Runciter's portrait or bust on them. You know what I think? I think these processes are going in opposite directions. One is going away, so to speak. Going out of existence. That's process one. The second process is a coming into existence, but of something that's never existed before.
Wish fulfillment,
Edie Dorn said faintly.
Pardon?
Al said.
Maybe these are things Runciter wished for,
Edie said.
To have his portrait on legal tender, on all our money, including metal coins. It's grandiose.
Tito Apostos said,
But match folders?
I guess not, Edie agreed. That's not very grandiose.
The firm already advertises on match folders,
Don Denny said.
And on TV, and in the papes and mags, and with junk mail. Our PR department handles all that. Generally, Runciter didn't give a damn about that end of the business, and he certainly didn't give a damn about match folders. If this were some sort of materialization of his psyche, you'd expect his face to appear on TV, not on money or match folders.
Maybe it is on TV, Al said.
That's right, Pat Conley said. We haven't tried it. None of us have had time to watch TV.
Sammy,
Al said, handing him back the 50-cent piece.
Go turn the TV set on.
I don't know if I want to look,
Edie said, as Sammy Mundo dropped the coin into the slot and stood off to one side, jiggling the tuning knobs. The door of the room opened. Joe Chip stood there, and Al saw his face.
Shut the TV set off,
Al said and got to his feet. Everyone in the room watched as he walked toward Joe.
What happened, Joe?
He said. He waited. Joe said nothing.
What's the matter? I chartered a ship to bring me back here,
Joe said huskily.
You and Wendy?
Joe said,
write out a check for the ship. It's on the roof. I don't have enough money for it.
To Walter W. Wales, Al said,
are you able to disperse funds?
For something like that, I can. I'll go settle with the ship.
Taking his briefcase with him, Wales left the room. Joe remained in the doorway. Again silent. He looked 100 years older than when Al had last seen him.
In my office.
Joe turned away from the table. He blinked, hesitated.
I don't think you should see. The man from the moratorium was with me when I found her. He said he couldn't do anything. It had been too long.
years.
Years? Al said, chilled. Joe said,
we'll go down to my office.
He led Al out of the conference room, into the hall, to the elevator.
On the trip back here, the ship fed me tranquilizers. That's part of the bill. Actually, I feel a lot better. In a sense, I don't feel anything. It must be the tranquilizers. I guess when they wear off, I'll feel it again.
The elevator came. Together they descended, neither of them saying anything until they reached the third floor where Joe had his office.
I don't advise you to look.
Joe unlocked his office, let Al inside.
It's up to you. If I got over it, you probably will.
He switched on the overhead lighting. After a pause, Al said,
Lord God.
Don't open it, Joe said.
I'm not gonna open it. This morning or last night? Evidently it happened early, before she even reached my room. The moratorium owner and I found bits of cloth in the corridor leading to my door. But she must have been all right, or nearly all right, when she crossed the lobby. Anyhow, nobody noticed anything. And in a big hotel like that, they keep somebody watching. And the fact that she managed to reach my room.
Yeah, that indicates she must have been at least able to walk. That seems probable, anyhow. Joe said,
I'm thinking about the rest of us.
In what way?
The same thing, happening to us.
How could it?
How could it happen to her? Because of the blast. We are going to die like that, one after another, one by one, until none of us are left. Until each of us is 10 pounds of skin and hair in a plastic bag, with a few dried up bones thrown in.
All right, Al said. There's some force at work producing rapid decay. It's been at work since, or started with, the blast there on Luna. We already knew that. We also know, or think we know, that another force, a contra force, is at work, moving things in an opposite direction. Something connected with Runciter. Our money's beginning to have his picture on it. A match folder.
He was on my vid phone, Joe said. At the hotel.
On it? How?
I don't know. He just was. Not on the screen, not the video part, only his voice.
What'd he say?
Nothing in particular.
Al studied him. Could he hear you?
He asked, finally. No, I tried to get through. It was one way entirely. I was listening in, and that was all.
So that's why I couldn't get through to you.
That's why. Joe nodded.
We were trying the TV when you showed up. You realize there's nothing in the papers about his death. What a mess.
He did not like the way Joe Chip looked. Old, small, and tired, he reflected.
Is this how it begins? We've got to establish contact with Runciter,
he said to himself.
Being able to hear him isn't enough. Evidently, he's trying to reach us, but... Now, if we're gonna live through this, we'll have to reach him.
Joe said, picking him up on TV isn't gonna do us any good. It'll just be like the phone all over again. Unless he can tell us how to communicate back. Maybe he can tell us. Maybe he knows. Maybe he understands what's happened.
He would have to understand what's happened to himself, which is something we don't know.
In some sense, Al thought. He must be alive, even though the moratorium failed to rouse him.
Obviously, the moratorium owner did his best with a client of this much importance.
Did Von Vogelsong hear him on the phone? He asked Joe.
He tried to hear him, but all he got was silence and then static, apparently from a long way off.
I heard it too. Nothing. The sound of absolute nothing. A very strange sound.
I don't like that,
Al said. He was not sure why.
I'd feel better about it if Von Vogelsong had heard it too. At least that way we could be sure it was there, that it wasn't an hallucination on your part. Or, for that matter,
he thought,
on all our parts, as in the case of the match folder. But some of the happenings had definitely not been hallucinations. Machines had rejected antiquated coins. Objective machines geared to react only to physical properties. No psychological elements came into play there. Machines could not imagine.
I'm leaving this building.